Okay, let's begin. So pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Minnesota House Human Services Finance and Policy Committee to order. So to make sure we have a quorum present, Ms. Lindsay Hansen is going to call the roll. So Ms. Hansen.
Good morning, members. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Representative Albright?
Present.
Representative Bolden?
Present.
Representative Burkle?
Present.
Representative Fisher?
Present.
Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Present.
Representative Keel? I'll circle back to her. Representative Liebling is also going to be a little bit late. Representative Moeller?
Present.
Representative Noor? We'll come back to him too. Representative Novotny?
Present.
Representative Pearson?
Here.
Representative Pinto? I'll come back too. Representative Rasmussen?
Present.
Representative Robbins?
Present.
Representative Sandell?
Present.
And Representative Schumacher?
I believe Representative Keel, will you call her name one more time, Ms. Hansen?
Representative Keel.
Present.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Okay, we have a quorum, I believe. So next in your in the agenda that was sent out were the minutes for the hearing yesterday, January 12th. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 12th?
Madam Chair, I'll make that motion.
Thank you. So moved. Representative Albright moves the approval of minutes for January 12th. Any discussion of the minutes? No, hearing none. Those in favor, unmute yourself and say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any opposed? Okay, motion prevails. The minutes for January 12th are approved. Thank you. So today we are very fortunate to have Commissioner Jody Harpstead. She's the Commissioner of Human Services, Department of Human Services. She's going to go through a presentation that I believe was very similar to the presentation she made in Chair Liebling's committee yesterday. I'm going to pause at certain times for questions. Commissioner Harpstead, feel free to pause yourself, and then I can open it up for questions. And then we should have time at the end for more questions. So before we begin, does anyone have any questions before we begin? If not, okay, the stage is yours, Commissioner Harpstead.
Well, thank you so much, Chair Schultz and committee members. Welcome to those of you who are new to this committee. And welcome everyone to 2021, which we hope will be a year of greater possibility and opportunity for all Minnesotans than 2020. I apologize to those of you who are seeing this testimony for the second time after it was we presented some of it yesterday, but we do have some new pieces for you. Again, I'm Jody Harpstead, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. I'll tell you that I spent time in December doing the performance reviews of my direct reports and basking in the capacity of this department that they had in 2020 for accomplishing our regular work, what we call breakthrough goals, and at the same time responding to the COVID pandemic with over 200 DHS employees redeployed to assist smaller state departments with COVID efforts. Our mission is that the Department of Human Services, working with many others, helps people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. We are the largest state agency, approximately just over 7,000 employees, And you can see how they split between the various administrations in the department. A better way to look at it, maybe easier, quicker. You can see if you look at the blue bars, how our spending is divided between our various areas. And of course, our healthcare programs, as we administer the Minnesota Medicaid and Minnesota Care plans, is the highest spend. On the other hand, our direct care and treatment services have our most employees. This is our organization chart. Our Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson, who's been with us for decades, very capably manages all of the overall operations and control functions from finance to HR, IT, compliance. And he also has a direct relationship with Marshall Smith, who runs our direct care and treatment services across the state. Going down the center column, you'll see our other assistant commissioners for our various human services administrations. Lisa Bailey is currently acting assistant commissioner for Children and Family Services. Gertrude Matemba-Matassa, assistant commissioner for community supports. Dan Pollitt, continuing care for older adults, and Matt Anderson, healthcare. I have several other key direct reports. Stacy Twite is our assistant commissioner in the commissioner's office. Karen McKinney is our equity assistant commissioner, and Amy Akbar, our general counsel. I'm so pleased that Nikki Farrago has recently agreed to serve as interim deputy commissioner for communications and relations. We serve children and families, people with disabilities, and older Minnesotans. Some people say we interact with almost everyone in Minnesota at some point in their lives. And first, we have a list of the services that we fund and regulate. As I mentioned, we administer healthcare coverage for Medicaid and Minnesota Care. We also provide economic assistance, food support, child protection, child welfare and support, care for older adults, services for people with disabilities, mental illness and substance use disorder, services to support people experiencing homelessness. We have our licensing division. And we have a direct service for people who are deaf or hard of hearing across the state. And then most of the services that we provide are in our direct care and treatment services. We have the Forensic Security Hospital in St. Peter, residential services for people with disabilities, specialty dental care, intensive residential mental health treatment, substance use disorder and residential treatment, and sex offender treatment. We often say that we serve the people in Minnesota that others will not or cannot serve because of their intense needs. Minnesota has been highly ranked again in recent years in human services, first nationally in delivering services for older adults and people with disabilities, third nationally in child well-being by the Annie E. Casey Foundation this past year, third nationally in healthcare access, quality, and outcomes, and seventh for overall health. And we have great disparity in our outcomes. People of color, three times as likely to live in poverty as compared to whites. As you can see, American Indian, Alaska Native, Black, African American, Hispanic, Latino population, significantly lower rates of optimal care. 68 of every 10,000 people of color experience homelessness compared with many fewer whites. American Indian children and children of color in Minnesota are more likely to be in out-of-home placement than white children, and we are working very heavily on changing that statistic. And recent data is higher incidence of low birth weight babies for mothers who are Black, African American, Asian, Pacific Islander, American Indian. This is a report that I've been showing to the governor and lieutenant governor every morning on the morning briefing for COVID. If you look at the bottom left, you can see our Minnesota healthcare program enrollment. And you can see that during the Great Recession, after 9 months into the recession, there was a 3% increase in enrollment in our public health programs. 9 months into COVID, there's an 8% enrollment in our Minnesota healthcare plans. And these charts are on the same absolute scales. So the reason the numbers are considerably taller during COVID is the Medicaid expansion population. On the bottom right, you can see our SNAP food support program. After 9 months into the Great Recession, we'd had a 5% increase in enrollment in SNAP. And after 9 months into COVID, a 6% increase in enrollment in SNAP. and at the top, our MFIP program to support working families, increase of 2% enrollment after 9 months into the Great Recession, and an increase of, I've got pictures in front of my chart, there it is, 15%, much more enrolled in the 9 months of COVID. This shows you the geographic disbursement of our some of our key programs. The map on the left is literally the population of Minnesota, 55% in the seven county metro, 45% in greater Minnesota. And the dispersion of our healthcare enrollments are almost exactly the same across the state. In terms of SNAP, there's a slight shift toward 57% in the seven county metro area, 43% in greater Minnesota. And for MFIP, again, just a slight shift toward the metro area versus rural Minnesota. Those two conspicuous white counties in the bottom are simply part of the Dodge Steele Waseca, otherwise known as County 74, and their data is consolidated in the county in the center. This shows you the age distribution of our key services. First of all, again, Minnesota's total population at the top, 23% kids under 18. And we are at 16% older adults now. And you can see from this chart that 39% of our health programs are children, but it's also true that 39% of Minnesota's children are enrolled in our health programs. 14% of Minnesota's children are in our SNAP food security program, and 5% of Minnesota's children are in MFIP. Here you can see the racial disaggregation of some of our key services. Again, the top is the racial disaggregation of the state of Minnesota from 2019. And as of November 30th, 2020, you can see the racial disaggregation in our health plans, though in recent years, we have a new process for enrolling people in our health plans. People get online and self-enroll. And so the question of race is optional, and you can see from the rust-colored bar to the right, 27% of people don't answer that question. So it's hard to see exactly what this is. Our SNAP and MFIP programs, you can see that the racial disaggregation there as well. Interestingly, the Latinx population, the Latinx population of Minnesota is two times their proportional share of the state of Minnesota enrolled in MFIP. The Black population is five times their proportional share of Minnesotans enrolled in MFIP. And for American Indians, nine times their proportional share of the population of Minnesota enrolled in MFIP. On the other end of the spectrum, you can see some of our services like our skilled nursing facilities in Minnesota and our assisted living facilities, 94% white. Our ICF and four-person group homes for people with disabilities, 87% white. And then day services for people with disabilities is approximately the same as the distribution of people in Minnesota. We had an opportunity to update our strategic plan in 2019 in the middle of everything else. We have three major components of our strategic plan: our Stand for Better Health, Fuller Life, and Lower Cost for Minnesotans Working to Achieve Their Highest Potential, a commitment to a culture of equity that advances equitable outcomes for communities across the state, and we aspire to be nationally ranked as a well-run state agency. Some of the components of our strategic plan include rewarding measurable health and life outcomes while managing costs through our managed care contracts, promoting the integration of integrated health partnerships, making Minnesota an age-friendly state, ensuring that people with disabilities and older adults live and work in integrated settings as opposed to congregate care. As you well know, the baby boom generation has not been eager to live in congregate care settings. And after reading about the experience of COVID, we're pretty sure that most folks are going to be less interested in that. And we need to continue to develop more robust integrated settings for people to age in place. Interested in our strategic plan and integrating services for substance use disorder, mental health, and housing, supporting family preservation and reducing disparities in out-of-home placement of children, and increasing access to affordable quality childcare. We've asked our assistant commissioners to imagine their biggest possibilities. If they imagine what they would like to accomplish over the next 3 years, what's the biggest possibility you can see? Our Community Supports Administration would incorporate class standards, culturally and linguistically appropriate service standards, into policies and procedures to improve quality and access to services among BIPOC communities. The iChirp model would be a standard of care for all African American and American Indian women served by our health plans. We would drive down disproportionality for African American and Native American children and families in our child protection system. And internally, DHS employees would feel valued for raising compliance and ethics concerns and working collaboratively to make systemic changes that support DHS's integrity. Our human services spending shows here by funding. You can see 53% of our funds come from the federal government, 34% from the state general fund, and then the rest from several other specialty funds. This was put in just to show that 97% of our budget flows straight through to services and programs, and 3% of the total is spent on administration. These are the grants that largely come out of the legislature for things that you decide are important for us to take on. You can see that 44% of those go to nutrition and housing. The next couple large areas are childcare and children and community in general, and behavioral health. This shows some of our forecasted program spending that adds up to $15 billion. I just wanted to note that if you take that very long bar at the top, which is long-term care and community-based services, and add the bar third down, elderly and disabled basic care, you can see how much of our budget goes to supporting older adults and people with disabilities. And then the rest of the bars add up to our support for children and families and other adults.
I'm going to pause there and see if there are any questions. I think that's an excellent point, though, Commissioner Harpstead, that so much of this budget is going in long-term care and for services for those with disabilities. Any questions from members to the commissioner?
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam. Commissioner Harpstead.
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to go back to a couple slides that piqued my interest, and I won't belabor the point. The first one, and the most recent was on your slide 18, was the very bottom. And if you could put that up on the screen, I could just kind of relate to it.
Matt? There we go. Yeah.
It's the last bullet point, and I draw your attention to that they feel valued for raising compliance and ethics concerns, working collaboratively to make systemic changes that support DHS. I'm not calling out the elephant in the room, but I know that there probably was a great deal of conversation with regard to the child care issues that were brought forward by Mr. Nobles and others with regard to that. And I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on that in terms of your thinking on it and what protocols and or processes you put in place that address that issue.
Absolutely. So you may remember almost exactly a year ago, Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson and our continuous improvement leader, Jeff Swanson, did a presentation to this committee showing the processes that we had put in place for CCAP program integrity. And our investigations unit has continued to use our new continuous improvement processes while working through a backlog of administrative reviews and introduction of investigations based solely on data tips. This has resulted in an issuance of warning letters, assessing and collecting overpayments, and other administrative tools that only became available as a result of 2019 legislation, for which we are very grateful to you. The effectiveness of our new processes are being tested as a result of appeals, and results look promising and have to date affirmed that we're moving in the right direction in this area. So thank you for asking.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. Commissioner Harstad, you also mentioned about the Medicaid expansion. And I understand that there is a sunset provision on that federal funding. Could you elaborate in terms of when that sunset is and what DHS is anticipating the repercussions for the reduction in funding from the feds with regard to Medicaid expansion? What responsibility will the state have to support those that have now enrolled onto Medicaid in the state?
Commissioner Harstad? You're on mute, Commissioner.
There we go. So, Chair Schultz and Representative Albright, I'm not familiar with the sunset provision of the expanded Medicaid funding, so I'm going to have to check that out for you and get back to you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I could just ask one more question.
One more, Representative Albright, go ahead.
Thank you. You mentioned in a very early slide the disparity in outcomes. Mr. Burdick, I'm sure, can assist in pulling that slide up. It's probably like two or three. There you go. Actually, I think it's the one before Mr. Burdick. Nevertheless, thank you for that. You know, disparity in outcomes, and I appreciate, you know, your desire to improve that, but we are talking about the disparities relevant to DHS as opposed to, and I understand this committee will be talking about housing and other things, but could you pinpoint with a greater specificity what you mean by that statement?
Well, this was the slide. So, Chair Schultz and Representative Albright, we're talking about different outcomes in terms of people of color living in poverty, people having different levels of health care, homelessness, out-of-home placement, low birth weight babies, for examples.
And so with that slide in mind, what recommendations or initiatives would you have us consider?
Commissioner?
Well, Chair Schultz and Representative Albright, it's going to take all of us many years and lots of thinking and plenty of action to deal with turning this around, obviously. It took us decades to get to this point, and it will take a while, and a lot of understanding and learning and commitment to action to make a difference in these numbers.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Representative Albright. I would refer you to the report on the Select Committee on Racial Justice for some ideas, Representative Albright. Next up is Representative Sandel. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Commissioner, are all the services that the agency provides offered by employees, or do you contract out for many of those services? Thank you.
Commissioner?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative. Matt, if you could go to the slides showing what we fund and regulate. The vast majority of what we support in Minnesota, we fund and regulate through other providers, managed care organizations, healthcare providers, and nonprofit providers. We have at the bottom of this page a small service for people who are deaf and hard of hearing that we administer ourselves across the state. And if you go to the next slide, you can see these are our direct care and treatment services that we actually provide across Minnesota.
Great. Thanks very much. I should have recognized that right away. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, the slide that you had that showed the sources of funding and the federal versus state funding made me wonder about the census and the upcoming results. And if we're thinking about possibly losing federal funds as a result of the census results, would you address that, please?
Commissioner?
Yes. Sorry, Chair Schultz and Representative, I'm not an expert in this area, so I would have to look further into it. What I do know is because of our actual drop in population, we're getting some additional federal matching funds now that we didn't get before. And so there's a possibility that federal funding could go either way based on our census, but I'd have to get back to you with a much better answer to that.
Representative Mueller? Any follow-up? Okay, any other questions? I don't see any raised hands. Commissioner Harp said there is a question coming into me via text. Can you respond to the enhanced rate during the pandemic that Representative Albright was referring to earlier?
Chair Schultz, I believe you're talking about our enhanced FMAP rate?
Possibly, or I don't, Representative Albright, do you want to ask your question now, please?
There is an enhanced, thank you, Madam Chair. There is an enhancement that's coming from the Fed for MA because of the pandemic, and I probably did not phrase the question correctly. I apologize for that, but could you respond to that?
Yes, we have received it.
Commissioner?
Excuse me, I'm sorry, Chair Schultz, Representative. Yes, we have received an enhanced rate for MA throughout COVID. It's been very, very helpful in us being able to enact various waivers to rules and regulations to allow people to continue their work during the pandemic. And that continues now at least through June of this year.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Harpstead, to the point that I raised earlier, what anticipation does DHS have in the event that the June 1 comes and the money from Washington stops? What recourse do those folks have that are now utilizing those services and now would be left without that enhanced pandemic rate?
So, Chair Schultz,
Commissioner,
Representative, we need to talk with you during this session about an entire plan we have for putting rules and regulations back together and for standing back up all of the processes and systems we've always had in our services. And so, as you probably know, during the summer session, there was a plan to move many of our executive order waivers into this session for your consideration for semi-permanent policy. And then we have recommendations we'll be coming to you with for the smoothest way to stand back up our rules and regulations coming out of COVID. And so as much as that enhanced FMAP helped us cover extra expenses during COVID, we would hope to be able to go back in a fairly smooth way to the funding and the normal revenue streams for our regular services after the pandemic.
Thank you, Commissioner. And we do have didn't our reimbursement rate from the federal government go from 50% to 50.5%, Commissioner?
Yes, Chair Schultz, it did.
Okay, I see a hand up. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. A question for Commissioner Harpstead. Kind of concerned on the wording on several of the slides, in slide 3 and slide 18, several references to driving down disproportionality of needs of some of the classes. I think I mentioned Native American children and African American children for protective services, and I find that alarming. It seems like the desire is just to change the numbers. I'd like your commitment that regardless of the racial makeup or background of any of the children in this state, that they will get the help that they receive or that they need, and they will receive that help. It just, like I said, just the wording, drag down disproportionality, seems like you're missing the focus.
Commissioner?
If you would like to change the need or remove the conditions that need to have child placement or foster services or anything like that. I just want that commitment that it's not a matter of just changing numbers, but changing the conditions. Thank you.
Commissioner Herbstedt?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative, it is our commitment to make sure that we conduct our child protection services and foster care, et cetera, equitably and the way it's intended to be done. There is a bias in the data today, and we would want to make sure that we were using an equitable approach going forward and that we didn't have a particular bias as we do our work.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think we need to proceed now, and we'll hold questions till the end so we can get through the slide deck. Go ahead, Commissioner.
This shows you for our MA spending, the most of the enrollees, of course, children and families in the green, and most of the spending on the seniors and people with disabilities in long-term care. This is our Children and Families Administration. You can see it's a $1.7 billion budget. It includes economic assistance and employment supports, child safety and permanency, child support, child care, and business integration. Some of the opportunities and challenges is economic assistance program simplification, the Family First Preservation Services Act coming to us from the federal government, reducing disparities of children in foster care, supporting, repairing, and modernizing our IT systems, which you will hear often from all of our departments, and high-quality child care supply and supports. This is our direct care and treatment services. Our major programs are mental health and substance abuse treatment, community-based services, which are really group homes for people with developmental disabilities, our forensic services, especially our security hospital in St. Peter, and our Minnesota Sex Offender Program with a $523 million budget. Opportunities and challenges there are new and updated treatment facilities, telemedicine, telepsych, tele-everything is what we went to during COVID, and where we should be after COVID is a major question that we're addressing in these services. Of course, this year, the issues have been COVID infection prevention and control, and I'm very pleased with how our direct care and treatment services have handled COVID infection control. We've had very few cases and very few deaths in the services across the state. And I think they've done a very, very good job of getting people through with safety and health. Stabilizing the funding is always a question for this group, demanding a demand for access to treatment beds and technology. In our Community Supports Administration, $761 million budget, the major programs, behavioral health, disability services, deaf and hard of hearing services, and housing supports. And their major issues are the behavioral health crisis services, the opioid crisis, a workforce shortage of direct support professionals and behavioral health professionals, affordable housing availability, especially for people with disabilities who want to be integrated into community, competitive integrated employment for the same folks, and expanding our school-linked mental health services. Our Continuing Care for Older Adults Administration with $131 million funding has our aging and adult services, nursing facility rates and policy for Medicaid. Planning and aging 2030 is a process we're working on. Fiscal analysis, performance, and operations. We have played a major role. We've had our Assistant Commissioner, Dan Pollack, semi-redeployed for COVID in looking at continuing to respond to pandemic needs at care facilities, staffing, vaccination, protocols, rules, and waivers, mostly in our congregate care settings like assisted living, substance use disorder facilities, mental health facilities, group homes for people with disabilities. We've been supporting nursing facilities to the extent that we can through Medicaid, and then remote and alternative home and community-based services for older adults. And as we come out of COVID, we want to get back to the work we have been doing on an age-friendly Minnesota. And our operations area, we have a $350 million budget, and we've got our Office of Inspector General there, our licensing division, our compliance office, our finance office, and human resources. And they are working on Operation Swiss Watch, which we kicked off in 2019 to improve our process controls. COVID modifications we've been dealing with all year, program integrity efforts, and those child care task force recommendations that we mentioned earlier. In terms of process controls, you may recall that my 90-day report in December of 2019 added up every error we could find from the year and pointed out they added up to 0.1% of our payments, and the department was not in total chaos. And to go after that 0.1%, we initiated Operation Stopgap and Operation Swiss Watch, brought in an outside national consultant to review our process control steps, and appointed process control champions. We also further centralized our financial and compliance functions across DHS. We've been able to remain very busy at this work, even through the pandemic, to cross our T's and dot our I's in all kinds of new ways. This top of the slide was in my presentation last year. The recent errors for which DHS has had to look at repaying the federal government was $103 million. Recent items for which the federal government has had to repay DHS, $94 million. In 2020, we've been working with CMS actually since the early 2010s on drug rebates that DHS has a right to recover from pharmacy companies for the state general fund, which added $74 million to the general fund this year. And I'm very pleased to say that 2020 errors for which DHS has to repay the federal government are zero. This is some of what we have done to ensure that we have better process controls in the department. Across the top, you see each of our assistant commissioners for our various administrations, and each of them has appointed a process control champion, someone who's second in command, reporting directly to them on their senior staff, whose job it is to be sure that we're crossing our T's and dotting our I's. They also have a dotted line to our chief compliance officer, Shireen Gandhi, and she holds regular meetings of all of them as a team to keep thinking about how we develop greater process control across the entire department. This is a project that came out of our Continuing Supports Administration and our Behavioral Health Division this year. On the left, you can see a whole set of steps to develop our better contract processes, and then our contract system, and then policy and training. If you look down through the to-do list here, you'll see that by April of 21, we hope to have a whole new approach in place for managing our behavioral health division. And by October, we extend that plan to the entire Community Supports Administration. We have also working on continuous improvement in behavioral health. Gertrude Matembo-Matassa is our new Assistant Commissioner for Community Supports, coming to us after successfully leading improvements at the Phyllis Wheatley Center. Paul Fleissner has come to lead the Behavioral Health Division via what we call an intergovernmental agreement with Olmsted County, where he's been the well-respected Deputy County Administrator. Jennifer Yang joined the Community Supports Administration from her role as one of the strongest leaders in our compliance department. And they are implementing the plan that you saw on the previous slide to improve the division's approach to grants and contracts that you will read about in an upcoming OLA audit about to come out. And I wanted you to see, even before that audit comes out, the plan that we have in place to improve all the work that we do in our behavioral health division. We've been working at DHS to implement a culture of what we call collaborative safety. There's a whole company called Collaborative Safety LLC, and they're helping us understand that the culture that we'd like to take on. The old view of safety was that people are the cause of failure. The new view of safety is failure is a consequence of deeper problems within the system, which we are absolutely learning in DHS. The old view of safety was learning ends with human error, who screwed up and what are we going to do about it, instead of learning begins with human error and let's figure out what systems and processes we didn't have in place that need to be fixed. The old view oversimplifies how incidents occur. The new view understands underlying systemic barriers and influences. And instead of looking for quick fixes and adding more training or something like that to the system, the new view looks at systemic change and preparation for unintended consequences. One of the founders of Collaborative Safety LLC reminds us that human services is one of the most complex systems that exist. We can put in all kinds of continuous improvement and process controls and steps and requirements, add humans, and it gets very complicated. And especially in our Minnesota state-funded, county-administered system, which also interacts very heavily with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid in Minnesota and the federal government. We are also working to develop an anti-racist culture at the Department of Human Services. This is the model that we're using. It describes moving from a monocultural approach to an anti-racist multicultural approach. A recent assessment by our strategic anti-racism team in green shows where they believe we are in symbolic change with the things we have started over the last couple of years and moving toward identity change. Our division directors, about 80 people, are the dark bars and thought we are approximately in the same place. They thought a little further ahead. And so this is our baseline benchmark as to where we are and the work that we need to do moving forward. In terms of our progress on anti-racism, we formed that strategic anti-racism team to guide our work. We are filling our remaining equity director positions, implementing the intercultural development inventory and orientation to anti-racism training through our top 40 leaders. Our 40 directors are next. We co-created a new hiring and retention plan for BIPOC, veteran, LGBTQIA plus employees and employees with disabilities, and added anti-racism efforts to our 360-degree feedback performance reviews. My greatest learning from my first year at DHS is the discovery of who gets heard in state government. I've been keenly present to the fact that if I don't proactively reach out to BIPOC and LGBTQIA plus communities, the people I hear from are the organizations who can afford the advocates, lobbyists, professional associations, and public relations campaigns. Of course, the larger, more well-resourced organizations. No surprise to legislators. I need to take this learning into the deepest levels of DHS to be sure we're equitably distributing the $17 billion of state and federal resources we have responsibility to make available to support all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Harpstead. I just want to highlight, I went through only one day of training for the Transforming Culture, and I learned a lot, and I wish all of our members could go through that. Maybe more of the three-day training would be even more useful. So I appreciate you rolling that out in your agency, Commissioner Harpstead. I think it really will make a difference in terms of accountability and compliance. We do have new members joining. Now we have Representative Neuer, Representative Pinto, and Chair Liebling. I'm going to see if they have any questions before I open it up to other members.
None. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Same here, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Chair Liebling? No. Okay. Representative Albright, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Harpstead, early on in the second half of your presentation, you mentioned IT maintenance and improvements. And I'm just wondering, what is that born out of? Is that born out of a failure of systems, equipment, or out of a concern? And I'm not trying to lead you to the answer, but because you are the repository for an enormous amount of data on our citizens, what fostered that to comment in your slide presentation?
Commissioner?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Albright. Of course, every organization on the planet struggles to keep up with modernizing IT systems and having the best systems that they can to do their work. And we do as well. And so some of our systems I've discovered as I've come into the department are 30 years old. And it's amazing that they continue to operate as well as they do. And so my comment was simply about trying to keep up with technology and have the very best possible systems. We also would hope to try to keep up enabling our county employees who need to administer our programs to have the very best technological interface with those systems so they can do their work. Always a challenge, never enough funding. And so it's just sort of a fact of life in our work that we're always working to try to keep up. I will tell you that we've been immensely impressed with Minit employees who work directly with DHS over the course of the pandemic and the number of things that they did rather heroically to enable our work. There was a time when the USDA told us that we had to recertify everyone for SNAP benefits, and our SNAP benefit computer run was tied inexorably to our Medicaid computer run, and we were going to have to recertify everybody for healthcare as well. But our Minit team figured out a way in 3 weeks to separate them so we could just do SNAP and not have to do healthcare. So they've been just amazingly heroic over the last year in fixing all kinds of things. And some of the biggest possibilities that they have in mind are fixes to our current systems to make them more user-friendly and stronger. And so I'm very proud of the partnership we have with Minit and the work that they do. But again, just a challenge for any large organization to keep up with technology.
Thank you, Commissioner. I agree. We need to start looking at making investments in IT because they are so outdated in Minnesota. I see Representative Pinto has his hand up. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, I realized that I did actually have, I was really more of a comment than anything else. And I'm sorry to have missed the first part of the presentation by the commissioner, but I saw the part at the end talking about continuous improvement. I just want to make sure to recognize the commissioner or team. I'm most familiar with that work in the area of childcare, and members will remember that a couple of years ago there were concerns about the integrity of that program, and there's been amazing work that's gone on. We had a presentation in the Early Childhood Committee earlier this year, this calendar year. Actually, this would have been just about a year ago now. But anyway, so I've kind of been involved in that and aware of that in that particular area, but it's just been incredible work, and I just want to thank the commissioner and the team for that. Because I've seen it in that one area, and I can only imagine it's been really successful in other areas too. So, again, thank you, Commissioner, for being here and in particular for that work.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Do you want to have a comment to that, Commissioner, at all?
No, but thank you for your comments.
Okay. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Harpstead. I just wanted to briefly say, you know, thank you for your comments about the work over at Minit for the last year. I know that Commissioner Tolmes has been working very, very hard with partners across the agencies to make sure that we were handling things throughout the pandemic. You may know that I am a member of the Blue Ribbon Commission on IT, and I know that
I think we may have lost Representative Bonner. Hold on. Okay, hopefully she'll rejoin. There you go. We've just missed the last minute of your comment.
Sorry about that. I don't know what happened. All of a sudden, it started buffering. Technology, right? So, yes, thank you. That is a huge issue, talking about modernization and specifically how we fund that. I also would suggest and want to thank Representative Albright for bringing that to the forefront. And I do think that as we go forward, we do have a new commission in the Senate focused on technology. And here in the House, we have loosely formed an IT caucus along with some of our members in the House as well. And so hopefully we can start to have some of those more deeper dive conversations and work towards really serving our populations.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Do you want to comment on that, Commissioner?
Yes, Chair Schultz, I just wanted to add that our federal relations team has been working closely this year with Congressman Betty McCollum, who has introduced a bill on IT modernization for state government. I'm not exactly sure of the extent of that or what may come out of it for us, but we're proud that Minnesota's leading the way in Congress to recognize that we need high quality technology in state government.
Thank you, Commissioner. See, Representative Albright, you have your hand up. I'm not sure if that's old or new.
No, I do have a follow-on question. Thank you for coming back to me. Commissioner Harpstead, it's kind of a two-part question. On your slide 59, could be 39, I forget. I can't remember. But I appreciate the efforts that you've made in your organization to improve processes and to appreciate that sometimes errors can be made, but that notwithstanding, the one word, and this is more of a comment rather than it's not to be a cut, but the one word that I don't see on that slide is accountability. I see a lot of talk about how we can work with processes and try to improve those. But in the ultimate end, Commissioner, there has to be accountability by someone for the actions or inactions of your organization, whether that be you or someone else. And so I would just impress upon you that concern that I have, as well as other members, that in the end, someone needs to reckon and become accountable for the oversights and or the indulgences, if you were, of the organization. And that leads me to my question. Sometime last year, there was a discrepancy in the payments to several tribal nations with regard to the opioid addiction. I have not heard whether or not that has been resolved or what the status of that situation is, and I'm hoping that you can respond to this committee in terms of where we stand with the disposition of that issue. Thank you.
Commissioner Harpstead?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Albright. First of all, everything we're doing in process control across the department is to create greater accountability of the entire department to the taxpayers of Minnesota. My 90-day plan and 90-day report presentations last year began and ended with the point that there's nothing more important for the Department of Human Services than to be trustworthy to the people of Minnesota, both those we support and those who give us the funds to do our work. And so the whole thing is about building accountability. I also learned in the department that that if people aren't given the proper tools to do their jobs well, we can hardly hold the person accountable if they aren't given the right processes and systems. And so we're trying to put the right processes and systems in place so people can do their jobs more effectively. To answer your specific question about the tribal MAT overpayments to tribes, for one thing, over the course of 2020, we completely cleaned all of the claims for those services and completely paid back the federal government for everything that had been overpaid. We're now working through, because there wasn't ever a legislative vote to take care of the overpayment to the tribes, we are using whatever administrative processes we have at our disposal to continue to look at recovering those payments. We are required by law in the Department of Human Services to recover those payments. And right now, the question of the tribal MAT payments is going through an administrative law review.
So just to reiterate that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Albright, do you have a follow-up?
Yes,
I just have other. We do have other members in line.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So Commissioner Harpstead, you mentioned that the payment was made. And was that done through your budget itself, or could you just elaborate in terms of where those funds came to repay the federal government?
Commissioner?
So every time we cleaned the claim, it sent money back to the federal government for what we were supposed to have done with those payments. And so they would come out of all of the normal funds that you saw here in the slides in terms of how we do our work between the federal government, Minnesota, and the counties.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm going to move to Representative Robbins and then Representative Neuer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Nice to see you, and thank you for your work on especially these process and program integrity provisions that you've been implementing. I have several questions. I think I'm going to focus on one that kind of dovetails to what Representative Albright was saying. On your slide about collaborative safety, I was intrigued about it, but I was also concerned because you talk about the need for all of these different systems and how complex everything is, which I agree with. But then at the very end, you say, but then once you add the humans in, then it's really complicated. And so my concern is that at the end of the day, it is about the person doing the job. And I'm all for good, efficient systems. I think that's important work. But at the end of the day, we have to hold the people in the chairs responsible and give them the tools. But if there's a problem, so I'd like you to speak more to about how in this new world you are going to hold people accountable, even if they have the greatest tools. If something is missed, what sort of process, because it should be a process as well for holding the human actors accountable, because the complexity really is driven that we're all people and we all are, you know, doing our best, but we'll make mistakes. And then secondly, you know, I was so glad to hear the federal government is repaid, and I was so glad to hear that these CCAP programs are being investigated and going through an appeals process, and I think all of that is fantastic work, but I just wish there was a way you kept us more regularly updated on that, because I was unaware of that until this meeting, and we only meet with you in these overviews once a year, so I think if there was a more regular process for you communicating those updates to us, it would improve the confidence of the legislature and the people in your work. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Commissioner Harmstead?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Robbins, there's a couple things about holding people accountable. First of all, the collaborative safety model is a model that came out of human services in the Department of Human Services in the state of Tennessee, actually, where they went to try to find a much better way to approach problems than they had been approaching them. And they turned to the aviation industry, the safest industry in the United States, to look at ways to create impeccable programs and systems and to keep them from failing. And what they found was when people look at problems that have occurred in aviation, they tend to look at what happened to the systems and what happened to the computers and what happened to the airplanes. And in human services, the history they found was that people tend to look at people and wonder who to blame. And so we're trying now also to fortify our processes and systems so that people are less able to make errors and to get the job done correctly and to do things well and to make it so that people are held accountable for the jobs that they have to do with the right tools. We would always hold employees accountable for doing their jobs properly and for doing the things that they've been instructed to do in terms of the way their jobs are supposed to go. So that if we found somebody not doing their job, we would hold them accountable through all of our normal HR processes for that. But I think there's a lot for all of us to learn in this complex human services environment between when is the problem, the system or the process itself, and when is the problem that an employee failed to do their job. And I think we need to keep talking to each other and learning about how that goes in this complex system that we have. And yes, holding employees accountable for getting their jobs done once we give them the right tools to do them. I would also say, if I could, that during COVID 2020, we've had a greater opportunity than ever to stay in regular touch, at least with our four chairs of our Health and Human Services committees. We've had to consult them with waivers that we've made to rules and regulations so that we could keep people working in Minnesota during the pandemic. And we are closer than ever to the four chairs of these committees. And I've been very grateful for that opportunity. So I appreciate we haven't had as many opportunities to do testimony with you and to keep you up to speed on everything that we're doing. We have had better than ever communications with the chairs of the four committees.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'll just add, if members have questions, you can always reach out to the legislative contacts within our agencies to get your questions answered via email or phone call. Next up is Representative Neuer. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner Hubbs. Thank you so much for the work that your department and everyone else is doing. My quick question is the COVID-19 relief. I had made some changes to some of the programs for the department. Just briefly, are we able to deliver some of those changes sooner, or when are we anticipated to see those changes?
Commissioner?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Neuer, I wonder if you could say more about the changes that you're referring to. I'm not quite sure.
Some of it, Madam Chair, some of it is related to the SNAP program and some of the waivers that you just talked about during the COVID-19 2020. I think this is more of an extensive discussion. We can have more conversation about it later.
Thank you, Representative. Commissioner?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Neuer, I will say we do need to come to you in this session with a plan that we still have to put the finishing touches on to put our rules and regulations back together from what they've been waived during COVID. We have thoughts about the best way to do that, to leave our system in the smoothest shape after COVID than it would be if we simply put everything back together the day the pandemic ended or 60 days later, as legislation calls for now. For example, we would have to look at recertifying everyone again on that same date a year later for a lot of our services, and it would be a nightmare project for the counties, for example. And so we would like to come with to you this session with a proposal for the smoothest way to put everything back together after COVID, if we could. And so I've appreciated the flexibility we've had to give flexibility to the providers, the counties, the tribes during COVID. And then we need to talk about the best way to put it all back together. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Neuer, do you have a follow-up to that at all?
Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bonner.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Harpstead. I just wanted to quickly weigh in for a brief moment about what we just talked about with Representative Robbins. I know that we had hired consultants to work with the agencies about a continuous improvement process. And I have to tell you, when we announced that program, I was very, very excited. And I will tell you all in full disclosure that in my day job, this is a big part of what I do in working with teams and organizations. And a huge component of that, just for folks who are not familiar with this, is a continuous feedback loop, right? Where we're constantly evaluating the processes and procedures that we have in place, seeing what's working and what's not, and seeing how we can improve those processes moving forward. There's a reason it's called continuous improvement. But I also want to address, too, when we talk about the people behind that. Obviously, the people in these systems are a huge part of that equation. That's very true, and most certainly. But I can tell you that after decades and decades of research in looking at root cause analysis and how things go awry, one of the things that comes out very clearly is that often it's not the people who fail, it's the process that fails the people. And I just want to be clear about that. And so the idea of working through continuous process improvement is looking at how those processes are working and how they directly impact the people who have to execute them. Because what we find is that most people have really good intent, but the process is not clear, it's ambiguous, it's not serving the individual or the role that they serve. And so constantly working through that process and how to improve those communication points, to reevaluate at every turn where things are going or what might be going well or not going well, is really, really vital. And I encourage you to continue with that process, obviously, and let us know how that is going for you. And I look forward to seeing what some of those continuing processes are that emerge along the way, because I think we're going to find some great benefits from it.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Do you have anything to add to that, Commissioner Herbstreit?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Bonner. I just wanted to mention that our continuous improvement team and our external consultant have recently, just this month, finished collecting all of the information they were planning to collect. And I'm expecting a report from them in February, and you'll be able to hear about that after we see it ourselves, so you can see what came out of that whole process. And yes, we intend to do continuous improvement after that. Our process in the Department of Human Services was delayed for a couple of months because our fabulous continuous improvement people were called to the SEOC to help them set up a process for COVID. And then they came right back to the work. And so they're about to issue a report, and we will share that with you when we have it.
Thank you, Commissioner. We'll be eager to put that on the agenda in February. So please remind me of that. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for joining us today. I was glad to see on the strategic plan the focus on operational excellence, and I was wondering, Commissioner, if you could talk about peer agencies in other states that you look to as leaders when it comes to operational excellence and what perhaps you and your team have learned from those states and look to be adopting in the year to come.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Chair Schultz and Representative Rasmussen, the Department of Human Services belongs automatically to a group of commissioners of Departments of Human Services across the nation, and I've been so eager to join that group and see what I could learn from my peers across the states. Between the things that I had to deal with when I first came to the job, and then COVID, and then everything else, I haven't been able to spend as much time with that group as I would like. I do know that many of our process improvement people inside the department have access to people in other states, and the consultant that we hired to look at our process improvement works specifically with other states. That's why we hired them, to tell us how things go in other places. And so, I would expect you will see some of that in their final report, and we'll continue to see what we can do to get into these forums and find out which states are best practice and what we can do to be like that. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Do you have a follow-up, Representative Rasmussen?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Look forward to discussing those reports more, and thank you for looking into that.
Okay, any other questions from members? No? Well, we really appreciate your time, Commissioner. We know how busy you are, and we are very grateful that you're leading the way in human services, and we look forward to working closely with you and your agency to improve things and to provide the necessary services our people need in Minnesota. So thank you for your time today. We appreciate it. And members, if you could stop sharing the screen. Thank you. So members, we're going to be meeting tomorrow at 10:30, and we were going to be having MDH, and I believe the Commissioner Malcolm will be available. So I hope to see everybody tomorrow at 10:30, and this meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.